Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the message operator for this Limewire Technical Net. It's been going strong for 44 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we all gather around the radio to listen and to speak, to teach each other, to learn from each other, and hopefully be a bit entertained by each other. Once again, I thank you all for returning this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. If you want to reach me via mail, that would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions, which were popular once upon a time, but they don't seem to be popular anymore. That was when people had questions and they weren't able to get to a radio to ask them, so they would email Dick, K2RIW, and he would answer them on the technical net. You could listen to the audio archive answers or listen to an audio stream. Or if you have a topic of discussion, if sometimes science and technology pops up into the news, and if you're aware of the technology, would like to share your understanding with the rest of us, we have people who volunteer. So you can email me and tell me if you desire to do that. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we used one recently, and we're scouring all of the Internet for more TechNet puzzles. You have technical puzzles of a science or technical nature, and they're kind of difficult to answer, but they're more conceptual. You can't Google them in 3 seconds, and email them to me, and I'll take a look and see what I can do. And also a call, WS2N, if you have a NASA space field story. Of course, you can directly email him. He has an email address. It's spacenetreport@gmail.com. But you can contact me. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. We have a link page over the week. If I see something interesting on YouTube or on some web page, for some article, I will cut and paste it and put it into the link page, and that's available 24/7 for almost ever and ever and ever. You can get there by typing in roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. It's been quiet lately, but that might change. You never know. You can reach it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And we also, as I mentioned earlier, have an audio stream of the Technical Net. I keep it live the rest of the week. So if you're curious what's going on in Glen Oaks and you're out of the radio range, just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you the audio stream of Glen Oaks. And as always, I like to remind people that my KC2NJI has archives of these Technical Nets that go as far back as September of 2006. His site is amateurradio.tv. He has over 1 million visitors, so it's an endless font of knowledge from people who have moved away from the area or, unfortunately, people who have become silent keys. So check it out. Okay, let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you our plans for tonight. Well, there's a couple very, very short comments about technology that I've kind of discovered over the past week. Some of you might know about it already. Some of you might not even know what it is. I'll bring it up at the very top of the technical net, and if anyone wants to make any comments one way or the other, they're free to, or not, as they wish. Then we'll get on to the usual questions and topics for tonight. I hope that people will present first the amateur radio-related topics, since this is an amateur radio net and a repeater. But we accept all kinds of science and technology, and the more the merrier. That should take us approximately to 10:15. 10:15 call, WS2N, will bring us the SpaceNet report, and that will be till about 11 o'clock p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the following week. So as long as my shack continues to work, the computer occasionally does weird things. My internet sometimes does weird things, and the repeater sometimes does weird things. So if everything is working the way it's supposed to, that's the plan for tonight. So with that in mind, let me drop, and I'll come back and tell you my new discoveries of things over the past week. I just wanted to mention, I'm always fascinated by the growth of capability in computer sciences, because I've been around since the Altair days. I had that issue of popular electronics of how to build your own personal computer from a kit. And I still remember in the 80s finding out that a 2-megabyte hard drive was $2,000. You can't even buy a thumb drive that has that lower capacity. So I recently was somewhat surprised, not a lot, but somewhat. Now, it's the month or two. Seagate will be releasing a new ultra-high-density hard drive. The biggest one that I was aware of until then was about 18 or 20 terabytes. This beauty is going to be 30 terabytes, and it uses a new type of technology that's developed over the last few years, and hope by the end of this deck to make hard drives available in 100 terabyte capacities, and they're all the same form factor as hard drives that are in your computers. So brave new world. Also, we used to, in the good old days, when Eric KE2EJ was around, argue about super-duper ultra-high-resolution technology for video. Blachick did a big presentation over this week. They announced the latest version of their DaVinci Resolve, which is a free video editor. So if you are curious what video editors look like and you have a computer, you can download it for free and play with it. It limits the resolution to 2K, but that shouldn't be a problem for the curious. Anyway, they make cameras also, and they had something as high as a 12K camera. And they announced that by the end of this year, they will be selling a 17K resolution camera. So for people who thought that 12Ks was just too low res for them, they can stick around and wait until the end of the year and buy a 17K resolution camera. I don't know exactly what you do with it, because I don't know of anything that displays 17K, but I'm sure they'll sell you that too. Anyway, so those are my two little discoveries of technology for this week. If anyone has any comments before we go on to the main question and answer session, please hit that push to talk.
You can record all signals, of course.
LB2LVQ with a comment.
Yes, LBQ.
I remember way back. I won second prize in a lottery in New York City, $900. Took that $900 and I bought a floppy disk drive, Apple computer, so I could have two disk drives. A floppy disk had a whopping 120K. Boy, was I happy. Back to net.
Yes, indeed. It's a good thing we didn't know what the issue would bring. I would be disappointed in filter. It's interesting. Your story is somewhat reminiscent. When I went to New York University, I won a geology award, which is interesting since I was a chemistry major. But anyway, it was $500, and unfortunately, I was young and foolish, and I decided that what I really wanted and needed was an automated turntable. So I got one of those laser-sold turntables that you could program it, because why should I listen to track one, then two, then three, then four? This one you could program any track in any sequence. And I enjoyed it for a few years. Of course, vinyl is, for many of us, a thing of the past. But some of us still have our vinyl records, and some of us actually listen to them. I remember this kind of click and all the nuisance. So I try and stay digital these things myself personally. But thank you for that, Ron. Anyone else with any comments? Good. Really? So on with the main segment. If anyone has any questions or topics or comments for tonight, preferably amateur radio, or any science and technology, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name, your call sign, whether you got a question or a comment for tonight.
KE2AMZ, Mike. I got a topic, question topic.
You're now intermittent, right?
Okay, Mike recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight?
Joe, KD2,
is the
question?
Okay, Joe, you're on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight?
Alpha 2 Golf Charlie with a question.
Okay, very good. What's your first name, sir?
Ted, Tango Echo Delta.
Okay, Ted, you're on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, hopefully as time goes on, there'll be some more questions or more activity. Mike, what's your question or topic for tonight?
Hey, Katie, Julian. Thank you, Roy. Well, as we all know, it's springtime, and we know it's photo time, parks in the air. I go out every weekend if the weather is nice. I just did a photo activation at Sagamore Hill. Managed to get 54 contacts. But both great. The technical issues about how to set up are great. How to do it is great. But which everybody seems to forget, which is our wonderful friends, the Tish. And they're out there. And they're going to be bad to hear. And if you think, just because you hang on the parking lot, at the picnic tables, etc., you're not going to get a tick because you're not going into the woods. Well, surprise, we have a new tick called the Lone Star Tick. And it loves to hang out in short, manicured grass and in sunny areas as such. But I just want everybody to be ready. If you're going to go out there, we got a lot of problems out there with ticks this year, and it's going to be even worse than ever. And what I like as a discussion topic, how do you prevent getting bit by a tick? What do you have to do? And if you do, you know, when you get bit. I mean, I've been dealing with ticks for a number of years, so I know. I want to open it up to the group out there and see what other people think. This is KD2AMZ.
Okay, Mike. I think it's more of a Long Island thing than a Brooklyn thing. I don't think Prospect Park has that much of a tick problem. Usually... ticks are parasites for deers and such, and they jump off and they'll bite anything. And they have a lot of internet organisms that they carry, which used to be somewhat esoteric. When I went to medical school, you would ask medical students and interns about tick bite organisms. But nowadays, it's unfortunately become so common and so many people have suffered it that it's not esoteric anymore. So if anyone would like to join Mike and suggest their methods that they've used to limit their tick exposure, feel free, hit that push to talk.
And, Roy, let me add one other thing. You just said I don't have to worry about Tick Prospect Park. Surprise, you do. You can get a deer tick bite in Central Park. You can get it in Prop Park. I'm telling you, surprise.
W2, says DH.
Yes, says DH. Please respond.
Having trouble here responding. Let me hang on for a sec.
Okay. Well, I mean, Mike, it's impossible. Just don't think it's as common as it is in other places of Long Island. But, you know, I don't know those particular numbers. I would just assume, just because of the geography, that it's not a high risk as much as Long Island is.
Surprise, Brooklyn is located on Long Island. And again, this is a phenomenon. Within the last few years, the Lone Star Tick has migrated to the Northeast. Usually I have migrating birds, so it's all over the place, even in the city.
Yes?
Hey, Roy, how you doing? Comment on this tick thing. First thing is Lone Star has been here a very long time. That's the original tick we've had on Long Island. It's been here for a long time. It's always been around. It's basically a dog tick, very similar to a dog tick. There's two ways to mitigate tick bites. The first is eat a lot of garlic, believe it or not. The garlic comes out in your sweat glands, and the ticks will not go near it for some reason. That they are, you know, it's like a chemical to them. You make garlic pills that you eat, which, you know, you just take a pill like an aspirin, and it keeps your garlic level coming out of your pores higher. which deters ticks from biting you. And the second thing is spray your clothes prior to going out with permethrin. And permethrin is a very toxic chemical, but not rude to mammals. And, of course, mammals. And it's not very dangerous to us. You don't want to drink it or breathe it in. But you can spray your clothes, let it dry off, and a tick will die immediately it steps foot on your clothes with the permethrin on it. K2S8, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Chris. Thank you. Yes, they sound like excellent things. Garlic is, I think, was plant toxins, you know, when it evolved. We just aren't affected by it and don't mind the smell and such. So, yeah, load up on your cold cuts, I guess, when you're going into the park. I did a quick little Google about Lone Star ticks living in New York City. According to Google, and this is just Google, they're primary in Staten Island and sometimes can be found in North Bronx. But I'll Google away as time allows. So thank you, Chris. Any other comments out there?
It'll be you with a comment.
Go on.
Yeah, I got, and let me just say good evening to everybody on the net. My understanding of the tick is that it's prevalent in Connecticut. Connecticut, they have a high incidence of Lyme disease, but the Lone Star tick does not transmit Lyme disease. And it's not clear whether it transmits the Rocky Mountain spotted fever either. As far as garlic goes, if it lands on me, it's going to die instantly. Back to you, RW2LBQ.
Okay, very good, Ron. Yeah, Lyme is, again, that when I was in medical school, it was esoteric. Now, you know, way too many people know about it because they've been affected by it. Anyone else with any cuts out there? Words of wisdom for all. Well, Mike, I think we've exhausted this, but I assume that you have some words of wisdom to share with us as well on the subject.
Yeah, I do. I've been dealing with these guys at work, at Brookhaven National Labs, etc. I wanted to get a discussion going. Yes, the Lone Star, by the way, I forgot the name of the disease, but it messes your immune system, so you can't eat meat. I forgot the name of that disease. As a doctor, you might be able to look it up, but there's a you can't eat red meat anymore. You become allergic to it. That's from the Lone Star. And then the deer tick is obviously Lyme and a whole bunch of others, dogs, etc. Pyrethrum, it definitely is a go. You have to be careful with it. You've got to put it on your clothing, spray it on outside, let it dry. Once a tick touches it, it will be dead within minutes. Be very, very careful with pyrethrum. It is toxic to cats and ticks, go figure. Not to people. You know, so it's perfectly safe to use on people when it when it's dry on your clothing. If people say DEET and stuff works, well, sort of not. It works on a tick, and while it's wet, all it does is give a little hot foot. Once the DEET drops up, you're just as vulnerable. DEET works by confusing the flies, that they don't recognize you as a breeding mammal. It confuses their nervousness, for lack of a better word. But I just want to make it clear. Hey, you go in the park, you go outside, you go everything, be very, very careful. I work at the BAIC Lyme and associated diseases for my own colleagues. This is stuff really nice in the loop, and it's a nice weather. And I like to go play POTA in parks in the air, and I like to go into the woods and away on the trails and stuff. But I just figured I'd open it up at the top for everybody to be safe, to be aware that, yeah, they're out there, and they are getting worse. And, yeah, they're in the Bronx, and they're in the, whatever, they're here on the island, and the Lone Star is actually even all the way up to Massachusetts now. It's all over the place as the Lone Star. And that little sucker will actually chase you down versus the dog or the tick, which will, as you walk past the bush, kind of latch onto you. So be aware of it. I just wanted to open up as a topic of conversation, especially with POTA. With that said, back to net, and let's talk more ham radio.
VQ.
Yaron?
Yeah, just final for me on this. I didn't in any way, shape, or form mean to insinuate that this tick is harmless. It isn't. Mike is absolutely right. It does come all kinds of other diseases, and they are pretty nasty. So he gives us fair warning. I appreciate that. But it is absolutely something to be careful of. Back in that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rod. By the way, Mike, I think you're thinking of something called Ehrlichiosis is the infection that Lone Star ticks carry.
Okay, well, again, Doc, you probably know better than I would, but no matter what, none of those diseases those ticks carry here, none of them are good. And I just want everybody to be careful and enjoy a beautiful day in the park and the sun. Be very safe.
Yes, indeed. It's not like they write in the comic books that you get bitten by a radioactive spider and you become a superhero. Usually getting bites, they pass on organisms that they carry, and it could be annoying to almost deathly, depending upon what's involved. Chris, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Roy. I just wanted to repeat the garlic thing. It's that's real. It's not a joke or one of those anecdotal type things. To the point, so I got that info from brother who was a director at the New York State DEC, and he spent a lot of time studying ticks and whatnot. Field personnel at the DEC are required by law now to actually eat garlic pills before they're allowed to go out field, and it's pretty interesting, but it's that's the best thing you can do to keep them from biting you, and the permethrin is the best thing to keep them from getting on you in the first place. So between those two, like you said, it's that meat-eating disease is nasty. I have a friend that if she eats a steak, she immediately throws up. It's crazy. Absolutely allergic to it, and that's a nasty disease to get. So be careful out there, guys. K2SDP.
Yeah, I mean, for some odd reason, these things that are born on ticks tend to provoke autoimmune disorders along with everything else. That's probably part of the method that this infection causes problems tolerating meat and such. But it's good that you brought it up, David. Mike, rather, everyone keep that in mind. Spring is sprung. The parks are open for business, and enjoy yourself and don't get yourself sick. So thanks to everyone for this question answer. I guess we'll move on to the next person, Joe, KB2DB.
Thanks, Ray. The call sign is Kilo Echo 2, Delta Bravo Echo. My question is ham radio related. I have a new Baofeng. And I noticed from my house to the Feldman repeater, it's probably 2 miles. It comes in loud and clear. But when I'm about 8 to 10 miles out, south of the Feldman repeater, I can hear the audio coming in clearly. But when I transmit, it's coming in as garbled. Not clear for anyone to actually hear what I'm saying. And the feedback I received is I can hear the repeat, but the repeater can't hear me. Not necessarily an antenna issue. So my question is, where do you recommend I start? Should I just try to mount an antenna higher and reach it with the current transmit with the wattage I have, or is it a wattage or an issue, I suppose? I'll clarify with that.
Okay, well, let me tell you a short story of my life. When I first got licensed, I discovered Limark. I had a ICOM AD92AD, very nice handy talkie. I was able to hear the repeater, but I could not be heard by them. Either I could not trigger the repeater, or if I triggered the repeater, I could not FM capture it. So, 80-90% was noise, and I got very discouraged when people heard noise on the repeat for a while. They said, I guess Roy. So I stopped using the Richter for a while. I thought I was going to be clever. I got myself a linear amplifier to boost my my 5 watts from my handy talkie up to about 80-90, and I got nowhere. So just pushing power for the sake of pushing power, usually not terribly effective. As you mentioned, antenna height is very effective. Dick at K2RAW, who ran this place for 40-plus years, had a comment about UHF and VHF. There are three important things he used to say about getting out on UHF and VHF. It's three things. It's elevation, elevation, and elevation. So if you can raise your antenna, you will get a much, much better signal out. If you get a bigger antenna, you might get a little bit more efficiency out. The big thing is raising it as high as you can. So I would focus my attention to that. It is not at all uncommon, even though we talk about antenna reciprocity, that if you, for all instances, if you hear a signal, you should be able to transmit a signal back to the source. That's kind of dubious because repeaters are high elevation, high power transmitters, and your Baofeng ain't. So it's very, very common to be able to hear a repeater but not be able to get a full quieting signal back to it. So again, my simple solution would be find a place to elevate your antenna as high as you can.
Question.
Yes.
Could we get a little more information on how many watts he's using, what kind of antenna he's using, if it's just an HT with a normal HT antenna that the HT comes with? We would have a little more idea as to what we could recommend.
Okay. I mean, your agency has a Baofeng. Baofengs are nominally about 5 watts of output. We could ask him if he got a deluxe antenna or he's using the kind of mediocre one that's packed together with the average $30 Baofeng. But my answer would continue to be the same, that if you really want to get far, you elevate your antenna. You know, getting a better one might improve things a little bit. Elevating it, you know, 20 feet is going to be a magical thing. So, Joe, Baofeng puts out about 5 watts. Did you go with the antenna that it was sold with, or did you buy a third-party antenna?
Good question. Definitely, I have two details that will help clarify. So I have a signal stick quarter-wave antenna on the Baofeng. It is watts. And one important thing to note is I was at ground level close to the bay. I'll be moving into that area, which is what I was testing. I will try next time on the second or third story. And based on this, I expect to get better results. I'll keep everyone posted.
Please do. I'm interested. Yeah, the higher you get, the better it will be. In some cases, when you're already elevated away from buildings, that will block signals. Pumping, you know, using an amplifier helps a bit, but, you know, whereas my change from 5 watts to 80 or 90 watts didn't give me any significant improvement, raising my antenna 20 feet increased my signals. I calculated something like, you know, 30-fold. So I wish you good luck. Also, it's a good thing if your window is facing the repeater as opposed to on the opposite side of the repeater. But, yeah, get up as high as you can, get the antenna as high as you can, and, you know, UHF and VHF is primarily a point-to-point contact mode. You can't really depend upon reflections and such. Some people do, and they get away with it, but for the most part, it's point-to-point.
KG2AMZU for comment.
Sure, Mike.
Okay, there's one other thing you can also try and do, which I did when I was stationed down at Fort Belvoir. I built myself a three-element Yagi, you know, from an old tape measurer. A Yagi also makes a huge difference. But again, height. That is really the major key. But hey, you can build yourself a three-element Yagi for about $20. That also made a pretty significant difference when I was down there.
Okay. You know, I mean, better antennas, more directional antennas, as long as you know where to point them, because if you point in the wrong direction, that makes things worse. It is a factor, too. But, you know, as you mentioned, as Dick always mentioned, elevation. That's the magic for UHF, VHF.
K2FE.
Yes?
I have, I think it was Joe out there, I have a Bell phone as well, not on it at the moment, but I do have a Bell phone, and I am on the beach in Brookhaven, so Bellport, if you know that area, right on the bay. I'm about probably 20-plus miles to the repeater in Selden. I can hit that repeater from my second floor of my house with 5 watts on the Bell phone inside of my house. And talk on it and talk to people. If I go downstairs on the first floor of my house, I cannot hit the repeater whatsoever. Can't hear it, can't hit it. So the height makes a big difference. I also have an external antenna that I can plug into that's up on my roof, and I can hit that repeater and talk on it 2 watts on the Bell phone. And the only other thing is make sure you do have it set. Your Bell phone has a high or a low setting, and some of them have a high, medium, and high, extra high. Make sure you're on the high or extra high setting. K2SDP, back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Yeah. You may get away without too much elevation if there's nothing blocking you. You know, if there's no buildings, if there's no hills, especially if there's a lot of water. Electromagnetic waves love to kind of skim the surface. Salty water and stuff. I have a 10-meter net on Sunday mornings. It was a gentleman in New Jersey who always operated portable. He'd drive close to a body of water, set up his little power treader, and we would hear him every week. So, there are other little nuances to improve your ability to get out, but, you know, elevation is the incredible magic bullet of them all.
I think you with a comment.
Go on.
I had a similar experience. I got a Tig radio handheld, and with the antenna that it came with, I could hear light wonderfully, but I could barely hit it. I had to change the position all the time, and everybody would say, just move over a little bit, try that. And I got a little longer antenna for the handheld, and the tri-radio puts out 10 watts. So it was better, but I was still getting, depending on what position I was in, all that. So I want putting a mobile antenna, a multi-band mobile antenna in the window. I even put it outside the window, just inside the window. And, of course, you're absolutely right. Height, elevation has everything to do with it. I'm over by the Hudson River. And I'm on the second floor, although my apartment building is elevated. Besides the height, a really good antenna that can give you some gain is sometimes better than an amplifier. That's just my tip. Back to you, Roy.
Hey, C2GS. Well, I agree with you, Ron. Like I mentioned, my origin story with LimeWire was abysmal, because I tried to trick Mother Nature by it was much easier for me to throw out my little credit card numbers and get a Mirage linear amplifier, but Mother Nature had the last laugh, and I was still that noisy guy in Brooklyn until I figured out a way to hoist a GP6 over my roof. And then I started to actually be able to communicate on the repeater.
WA2BSN with a comment.
Yes, Stu?
Well, good evening, Roy. I found for many, many years of 5/8 mounts on the top of my car and always worked well for me with an HD.
Well, yeah. They certainly work reasonably well. They don't give you quite the elevation, but you have somewhat more open environment on the road than you do in your house or in a building or in a valley or what have you. So they're fine. I've told people if they can't mount an antenna on their roof, they should get a mag mount and a cookie pad and put them together and see what happens. Hopefully, if you could put it on the outside of your building. I've told people if they have air conditioner boxes kind of jutting out of the wall into the outside, they could put the magnetic mount on the air conditioner housing. And in cases, people have been known to place the mag mounts on top of their refrigerators in their kitchen, and sometimes they get out. So there's a lot of compromise solutions, but the simple, easiest, and the most remarkable is to elevate your antenna. Then, you know, there's no equivocation about it. That kind of does magic.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. The other thing is I have an amplifier from one in and 50 out, but I haven't used that since 90s, but the Green's Mag Mount does it in a previous time. I'll get back to you and have a pleasant evening. WA2VFM.
Thanks, Stu. Likewise. Anyone with any comment, please hit that quick look. Okay, what's your comment?
This is JD Duage, Mobile, Rockland. Just a question on how does the various positioning of these antennas affect the SWR? Basically concerned with can a position of an antenna have a very bad SWR that would harm the transmitter?
Okay. It sort of depends. Can you orient it in a weird position and have a mismatch? Yeah, you could do that. It's a little bit on the difficult side because most UHF, VHF antennas, unless you go for the extended models, are kind of small, compact, and there's kind of not much terrible things you can do with them. Tend to want to orient your repeater antennas vertically because the repeater tower itself has a vertical antenna, and you want to get the most efficient transfer of energy. So it's not a good idea to have a horizontally oriented antenna, and most UHF, VHF antennas tend to be designed to operate vertically. So, you know, other than bringing it in the ground, I can't think of any way to screw it up that much.
Okay, thank you very much. Back to the next.
Welcome. Anyone with any other comments, please hit the push to talk. Yes, please.
The comment about being able to reach around Belcourt Village makes me feel good about the height. My location will be South Bayport, similar location, just a bit from west, so I think technically closer to repeater. So gives me good faith that the height alone will make it work. If not, I do plan on either making some type of Yagi or some Comet antenna in the attic if possible. Ideally outside, we'll see. Thanks again, guys.
Okay, very good, Joe. Yeah, I mean, attic antennas are reasonably okay. I know people who have had them and still have them. They certainly don't get buffeted around by the wind as long as you keep them away from the family. You don't want them anyone to be irradiated with RF. Hopefully, you know, this new experiment will be a success, and I hope you come back and tell us all about it. AC2GS. Okay, let's go on to the next person. Ted, AA2GC. Question or your comment for tonight, eh? Ted?
Good evening, everybody. Basically, it's an antenna question, an SWR. It puts an NFED, and they got a 59-foot wire antenna on the roof, which I think has a 9-to-1 attached to a 50-foot coaxial cable, and I believe it's supposed to be for 40 to 10 meters. And I attached a nano VNA to check the SWR, which is reasonable from 40 to 10. And I checked it for 80, and the SWR is really off the wall. So I have a Kenwood 440AT with built-in antenna tuner. which tunes all the bands, but I noticed that it even tunes 80 meters down to a very low SWR. But with the nano DNA, it was really off the scale, so I was wondering what was...
Ted, you jumped out of the repeater.
I don't know what I got up to. Did I hear anything about the antenna? Where did I drop off?
Just the last 10, 15 seconds you dropped off. I heard most of it.
In any case, the SWR on the NAMI and A was very high on 80 meters, but the antenna tuna on the Kenwood 448P tunes 80 meters down to a very low SWR. So I just did not understand what was happening. Would it be safe to transmit 80 meters?
Okay, well, if you're able to transform the impedance down to the 50 ohms required by your transmitter, it's safe. Is it an efficient use of the antenna? Probably not. You get a degree of loss when you need to use your antenna tuner, and this leads to many arguments on 75 meters and such, that some people say that antenna tuners are miracle workers, and the other group says that they're just confidence grifters, faking your transmitter stand to thinking that it's tuned when it really isn't. The problem is that there's going to be an additional series of reflections back and forth on your transmission line if you adjust the mismatch via your antenna tuner. So will you be able to use your transmitter? Yes. Will a signal get to your antenna? Yes. Is it a very efficient mode? Is it as good as having a resonant antenna? No, but it's better than nothing. So you could try it out. You could see how things go. But as long as you have it 2 to 50 ohms of impedance, your transmitter should be more than happy to deal with it. So it's just that the random end fed kind of ran out of resonance before it reached 8ers, and you're correcting it by tuning it with your antenna tuner. I'm a joke. And occasionally tell people that my Talstar can tune a doorknob. I wouldn't want to use a doorknob as an antenna, but I could adjust the settings so that it would present itself as a 50-ohm impedance device so that my transmitter would be kind of happy with it.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I think he said he has a Kenwood 440, which is the same one that I have. That antenna tuner in there. It's very good. Your SWR can be pretty far off. You know, I used to put different antennas up, different dipoles. Sometimes I'd be, way off on my measurements. And yet, that antenna, boy, that thing really worked well. Even so, it was very far off. To me. Back to you.
AC2GS, well, that's good to hear. It's my understanding that for the most part, Japanese radio antenna tuner circuits were kind of designed to go as far as about a 3-to-1 mismatch, and not much more. You know, something to do with the fastidious culture and such that, they'd be embarrassed to have an antenna that had a 7 or an 8-to-1 mismatch, not being resonant. But do you know offhand what the theoretical mismatch SWR limitations are? The problem with antenna tuners is that there's really no such thing as, well, they tune to 3-to-1 or they tune to 10-to-1. You pretty much need to have a Smith chart designed to point out the different impedances with different angles and such, vectors such, for each design of these antenna tuners.
W2LVQ with a comment.
Yeah, well, I would say SWR on mine on 15 meters, I put a 15-meter antenna together, and I was off on the measurements, and it was like 6-to-1, and yet the antenna tuner is still tuned. I was still able to get out. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. I assume not all Japanese antenna tuners are designed to the exact same specs. Ron, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Roy. Just, for me, SWR is something that whenever I have SWR problems, I always go back to the basics. It sounds like you've got a couple of different lengths of wire. I would be looking at connections. I would be doing connections just to be absolutely sure. Because, like you say, an antenna tuner, they make them, they work, they're wonderful, but they're lost. Some of the deficiency of your just becoming heat. But I go back to basics with SWR. What am I running? What kind of mismatch do I have? Why do I have a mismatch? Back to that.
Yeah, Ron, it's a matter of whether you want a Band-Aid on it or whether you want to bring it back into the shop and solve its problems. There's kind of basically three big factors when it comes to a non-resident random end-fed. Assuming the components work, the connections work, the ballon works, you can adjust the length of the end-fed wire. You can adjust the effective counterpoints. The way that you can have two different methods of having a real counterpoint on your end-fed. You can either have a piece of wire that's attached to the 9-to-1 ballon, or if you want the laws of physics to take care of it by themselves, if you don't provide it with a counterpoise, it will use the outer shield of your coax transmission line as a counterpoise. Then you can adjust the length of that counterpoise by introducing an RF choke at one point down the length of the transmission line. And the other parameter I would say that's really important for NFETs is the elevation. The closer you bring it down to Earth, the more you've coupled with the Earth and your resonance and such. So it's a position, it's length of the NFET, and it's length of the counterpoise. Ted, any comments?
Yes. The thing that puzzled me was that when I used the nano DNA to check the SWR for the band 4310, it was certainly within like between 1 point something and 3. But when I checked it for 8 meters, it was off the scale of the DNA. It was in 8 or more. So I was surprised that the antenna tuner and the radio would tune that. So I was wondering if I was doing something wrong, unless the antenna tuner is better than I thought it was.
Well, I would assume the antenna tuner is better than you thought it was. It depends upon the type of design. There are different types of impedance transforming circuits. There are T circuits, there are L circuits, there are pi circuits, a whole bunch of others. Some are better at things than others. It depends upon the amount of inductance and capacitance in the components that the antenna tuner has. Like I said, there are some antenna tuners out there that can fix a 10-to-1 mismatch. So if you had an 8-to-1, it's doable. Again, you pay the price in reflections going back and forth through the transmission line and the inevitable losses entertained every time it's going one way and the other. But again, it's doable.
All right, well, I think I have you guys answered my question, and I now will try to transmit on 80 meters with the hope that no one's a mushroom cloud.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to have a problem as far as destroying anything. You might have a problem have people picking up your signal, because as I mentioned, the efficiency of something like that, the decline, there's a big difference between getting something that, quote, tunes and getting an efficient radiator that tunes. If you've ever seen these ham sticks, they sell them for ridiculous sizes. They sell them for 160 meters. But I believe that someone tested the efficiency of it was either 80-meter or 160-meter ham stick. They found out that the antenna efficiency, the amount of power you put into the amount of power that gets radiated as RF, was something like 2-3%.
November 2,
Zulu
Charlie.
Yes, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, good evening, Roy. Good evening, Matt. Roy, with your last illustration there of the three parameters, and one of them being counterpace, would it be accurate then, using that thing, as you said, that in a center-fed dipole, that one leg of the center-fed is the counterpoise.
Okay, well, it's kind of looking backwards and reverse on everything, because usually when it's explained how monopoles work, invariably what people do, including myself, is to take the center-fed dipole as the standard, and you could remove half of the center-fed dipole as long as you place a mirror that provokes a virtual image of the monopole on the other side. So you could say that a counterpoise, that the second leg of the dipole is like a counterpoise. It's probably a little bit more accurate to say that the counterpoise is similar to the other dipole of a center-fed antenna. But, you know, I mean, it works in both directions, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Maybe more accurate is then that mimics or replaces center-fed.
Yeah, to a degree, yeah, that's what it does. I kind of like to compare it to a swap, that you need something in some way on both sides. Otherwise, if you sort of seesaw in half, it's not a fun experience, in my opinion.
Okay, Roy, then we can bring him to that on the side
now. Okay, very good. Any other comments on the subject? Please hit that push to talk.
To R2K?
Yes.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. Question. The MC example, someone was able to find out that only a certain percentage was coming out. If I wanted to find out, hypothetical, I'm pretty tuned up in general, but if I had 100 watts and my tuner took care of a 4 to 1 and, you know, brought it to, let's just say, a 1 to 1, what is actually going out? I mean, I have a 259 analyzer. I don't know. Is there a chart? Do you need an instrument? Is there a rule of thumb as far as once your tuner is taking care of whatever number anyone knows for reference, say a 4 to 1, what's the percentage that actually makes it out? Or we don't know.
Well, there's nothing accurate because it's kind of difficult to measure, but there are approximations and there are charts. And the two important functions, the three important functions is the SWR, the length of your transmission line, and, well, the type of your transmission line, and the frequency you're using. Because as the length increases, losses increase, the frequency goes up, the average of your coaxial cable has greater losses. So, those are the underlying problems. So you can Google it, and you can get a rough approximation of how different SWRs for a given type of coax cable at a given type of frequency will affect the efficiency of your transmissions. Don't expect them to be 100% accurate, but you're in the ballpark.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, if I'm in conversation with someone and they tell me that they were able to tame a certain horrendous WR, I want to let them know, give them motivation, that's good. So I'll check out that chart, so I'll say, well, that's all well and good, but after you're 100 watts out of the box, you know, the antenna's only seeing this. So I look forward to looking. I'm going to dig that up, and thank you.
You're welcome, and I hope you get a positive reaction. Again, the topic of antenna tuner is probably the most heated on the lower frequencies, where it's almost like a religion. You know, there are some groups that if you tell them that antenna tuners are useful, they'll throw things at you on the air. So I hope that whoever you have these conversations with is open-minded.
Yeah, no problem with that. It's just good that people understand everything like that and, they'll turn a tuner into a toaster. So that's good. I wonder if different tuners would do a better job and let more power out at the same time. But, so that's all good. So far, so good right now. Thank you.
LZQ?
Very good. Yes.
Let me see if I got it.
Ed, stand by. We have someone else first.
W2LVQ?
Yes, Ron?
Yeah, my finding about antenna tuners is that they're very useful. And if I had a radio that had an internal antenna tuner and I had an issue with an 8-1 and it brought it down to 1-2, I would be happy. But I would be careful to continually monitor the temperature of the radio, because antenna tuners, the way they work is trade-off is heat. So, got to be careful. That's all I got. Back to you, Roy, W2LVQ.
Okay, very good. Well, I used to have a joke, a running joke with Dick. Dick was a very big proponent of correcting things with antenna tuners. And, he would mention that, he would do thermal tests on these things, and they didn't heat up that much. Most of the energy loss in my readings and experiences are the attenuation losses of the reflections of the mismatched signal going back and forth through the transmission line. So the heat dissipated across the surface area of the length of your transmission line, I would say 95%+. It depends, of course, on the nature of the components used in the antenna tuner, the inductors and the capacitors, that they make good contact. A lot of times, my Calstars are silver-plated, the inductor, so the amount of resistance is rather low. The amount of loss in the antenna tuner itself tends to be relatively low. You get more loss in the inductors than the capacitors. So the primary worry about heat dissipation tends to take place over a large surface area of the transmission line. I used to joke with Dick that his perfect antenna tuner would only be able to be built if you had a budget and access to the jet propulsion lab facilities. Okay, Ed, before you, GJE wanted to make a comment, and then I'll get right back to you, Ed. So, first Ed, first.
Good evening. If the length of the antenna is wrong, either too long or too short, we have SWR. When we use an antenna tuner, and we put an SWR meter between the antenna tuner and the transmitter, we adjust it so we get a perfect match or almost perfect match. But we would put an SWR meter between the antenna tuner and the antenna, still have SWR, and we still have all the losses that are associated with mismatch, some of it being dissipated in the core cable and some of it being dissipated in the antenna tuner itself. We never correct the SWR at the antenna. What I used to do years ago and drive one of my relatives crazy helped me, I used to have a net on 40 meters, and until I got the SWR down by trimming my dipole, I was driving my relative crazy helping me trim that antenna. But the SWR is always there between the antenna tuner and the antenna. Over.
Yes, you're quite right, Ed, and that's why it doesn't make a lot of sense. Occasionally, people get things wrong, and they put an SWR meter between the transmission line and the antenna tuner, as opposed to between the antenna tuner and the transmitter. So you're right about that. But in a way, you can get the impedance transformed at the point of the antenna feed point. People do sell and use external antenna tuners that go right up against the feed point of the antenna. Are you still doing the same thing if you took if you tested the SWR for the fraction of an inch between the output of the antenna tuner and the input of the feed point of the antenna, you'd still have a mismatch impedance. But, you know, theoretically, it gets it closer there. The big problem is that these messages produce reflection, multiple reflections, and every time it goes back and forth, attenuation losses.